I'm going to New York with you. You know, Bucky Harris, the Yanks manager, gave me a job as coach for as long as you're on the team.
Look, Abbott, if you're a coach, you must know all the players.
I certainly do.
Well, you know, I never met the guys, so you'll have to tell me their names, and then I'll know who's playing on the team.
Oh, I'll tell you their names, but you know, strange it may seem, they give these ballplayers nowadays very peculiar names.
You mean funny names?
Strange names, pet names, like Dizzy Dean and...
His brother Daffy.
Daffy Dean.
And their French cousin.
French?
Gouffet.
Gouffet Dean, oh, I see. Well, let's see, we have on the bags, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out.
I say, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You're going to be the coach, too?
Yes.
And you know the fellow's name?
Oh, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name?
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first base.
Who?
The guy playing
who
first.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
Look, you got a first baseman?
Certainly.
Who's playing first?
That's right.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it.
All I'm trying to find out is the fellow's name on first base.
Who?
The guy that gets the
money. That's
it. Who gets the money on
first base? He does, every dollar. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of True Stories of Tinseltown. And I am so, so, so excited today. And I have told you guys for a while that this woman is coming on the show. And I really grew to love her and her family by reading her book twice. And I have Carol Chris Costello with me. I'm sorry, we were talking about your sister. Hi, Chris.
Hello there. How are you doing, Grace?
I'm doing great. And thank you so much for coming on. And I want to thank my friend Stone for getting you on, Stone, whilst mentioning it. I love him.
Yes, he's wonderful. We communicate through Facebook. He's a very identifiable name up there. He sounds like an actor. You know,
yes.
I always look at the name thing. He should be acting.
Like Stoney Curtis on the Flintstones or something.
So thank you, Stone, very much.
And thank you, Stone, very much. I love him. He's been on my show twice, and he's going to come on again talking about noir gangsters of the 50s. So we'll be doing
does
that.
He talk gangsters of the 50s?
Yes. Well, we talk gangsters of the 30s and 40s, and we talked about his book on George Raft, which is fabulous.
Oh my gosh.
Didn't know anything about George Raft, and I read Stone's book, and I read it from start to finish, and like... Chris has written a book, and I'm going to tell you guys, I loved this book. Chris is the daughter of Anne and, more famously, Lou Costello of the famed Abbott and Costello team. And Chris wrote a wonderful book. It's called Lou's on First, and I read it twice. I loved it. I learned so much about your family, and I felt a part of it. You did so much about their career, but I really loved the family side of it. And I loved all of it, but it was just so good. Such a great read. So I cannot tell anybody.
And I think that's what I really wanted to do when I started out on that journey, is I wanted people to like walk in, into our home, into our life, and to see him as the man, as the father, as the husband, the brother, the son, and the other half of Abbott and Costello. And it was a four-year journey, I'll tell you. I mean, I became so obsessed with it.
Well, you did a great job. Fabulous.
Thank you so much. But I always say I didn't write the book. Everybody that I interviewed wrote that book.
But you put it together, and you took the time and the effort, and you wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it was honestly, you guys, you love it. And you accomplished what you set out to do, because I felt I walked right in.
Well, thank you, Grace, very much. Well, I have to give credit to the co-author, Raymond Strait, who is a Hollywood biographer, because he had such a feel for the era. And, he and I worked together to bring it into story form so that people could kind of see, how the era affected, certain things of that time period, et cetera, et cetera. So together we did it, and I'm very proud of it because it was 22 years in print.
I can't believe that.
I know, never a negative review, thank God. And it still has a life force. We're now in an ebook, so people can get it through Amazon or Barnes & Noble.
Definitely get it, you guys. I say I like a lot of books, and I do. But this one, it's like a family book, too. It's not just about a career. It's a family book, and it gets you inside there, and it's really fascinating. and interest.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
And I mean thank that you. 100%. Well, I did read it twice.
You know, even today, you know, there's so much we still uncover. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, I wish I were doing the book now. I forgot to incorporate that. Or, oh, that one. Oh, I didn't know that. So more keeps, you know, coming through, you know, the cracks, which is great.
Yes. And you should put maybe add a couple chapters to it or something with some of the new stuff you found out. Like an after,
you know what?
Afterward.
You know what I said, Grace? That was my first and my last book. That one is—it's hard. It's hard to write a book.
I know. It amazes me. I talked to this one woman who wrote the biography on Barbara Stanwyck, and it was 800 pages, and it only went to 1940.
Oh wow! Oh wow! Wow!
Well, she didn't come back on, but she gave me a lot of great guests. But she was an editor, a big poobah editor, so you know she,
oh my god,
but my 800 pages to 1940.
Oh, that's my a lot.
Yeah, I did not read that book twice. Okay, so let's get into your dad was a Joisey boy.
He was a Joisey boy.
Patterson,
born and raised, and that stayed in his heart, boy, those Patterson roots to the day he died. You know, he never forgot Patterson. Well, as you know, when you've seen like Naughty 90s, you know, the backdrop is the Patterson Wolves and in the TV show and in some of his films, you know, on stage, he was always bringing, you know, Patterson in as a mention. He was very proud, very, very, very proud, you know, of his city. In fact, there's a Lou Costello Memorial Park there with his statue,
statue. How nice.
I know. And with the mayor of Patterson, I want to pronounce his name, but I feel I'm going to pronounce it wrong, but he is wonderful, Andre Saya, and they have just gotten a $500,000 grant to do a complete revitalization of the park with a playground for the kids and a barrier area for even autistic kids.
Oh, great.
Which I know Dad is really smiling on that one.
Yes.
That's his whole passion was kids.
Oh, he
loved kids.
He sure did. So he wanted to be a star. That was when he wanted to be a movie star.
He wanted to be a movie star.
That was
exactly
his thing. He didn't want to be a comic. He didn't want to be in burlesque.
No.
He wanted to be a movie star.
Well, that's true. You know, as a kid, you know, he always loved Westerns. You know, always, always, always. And his idol was Charlie Chaplin. But he looked at Charlie Chaplin more as an actor, not as a comic. And he would impersonate him as a kid. And he won a talent show at a school impersonating Charlie Chaplin in costume, et cetera. But no, he really, really wanted to be an actor. So when he got out of school, he decided he was going to go to Hollywood. He wanted to try to see if he could, you know, break into the industry in Hollywood back then, which would have been probably around the mid 1920s. I don't have my own book in front of me.
Then, because silence was still gone.
Oh, I know. Well, his parents were adamantly against it. Now, different era. Okay, it was an era where you graduated high school, you got a job, and he had his sights set on Hollywood. So, his brother Pat, who was an accomplished musician with his own band, very well known in the Patterson area, New Jersey and New York, had actually given him the money so that he wouldn't have to hitchhike and he could take the bus. Well, when Pat left him at the bus station, Dad decided, I need this money for Hollywood, so I'm hitchhiking. And he did. He hitchhiked all the way to Hollywood, California.
Amazing.
And as I think he said on This Is Your Life, he said, I slept in many a parked car, eating a lot of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, but he managed to get into the MGM lot, and he got onto a construction crew. From that, he was an extra. He was even in Battle of the Century, Laurel and Hardy. If you look at the film, he's ringside in that film. We post a lot of that one particular picture on our Facebook a lot because, you know, people are really interested in it. And he's very young and very trim, and you can kind of see the mannerisms of Costello, you know, emerging, you know, some of his trademark, you know, expressions, etc. He also was in, I can't remember the name of this film. It was a film about a college team playing football, and they were supposed to descend upon this one player, which was Dad, and they had dug this big hole so that he would run into the hole, and then they would pile on top of, you know, the hole. And he fell into the hole, and then everybody fell in on top of him, but he said he couldn't breathe. So, you know, that kind of, that was a short-lived career. he, I think, doubled for Dolores Del Rio, did some stunt
work. Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, he actually injured his leg during falling out of a window in a stunt. Yes. And he then proceeded to go into another film called The Trail of 98, which was a silent epic. And Don't Blink, but he walks into the saloon. It was during the Gold Rush, you know, Klondike era.
Yeah.
And you see him in a cast. And that was for real. That was for real. The cast was for real. But as I said, Don't Blink, because it's so fast. But I think what happened is that it was Dolores Costello, the actress.
Yes.
Who took him aside and said, look, if you're really honest about doing this, if you're really sincere and this is really what you want to do, I'm going to encourage you to go back home, hone your craft, and then let Hollywood ask for you. And he took her advice. So he had what money he had left. He got as far as St. Joe, Missouri, ran out of money. He's in a coffee shop, looks across the street, and he sees this advertisement for them looking for a Dutch comic. And he walked across the street, and he had no idea what a Dutch comic really was. But the guy, you know, told him, explained, you know, you speak with a Dutch accent, you'll wear oversized shoes, you know, you'll have oversized clothing. And he said, no, 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 I'm not going to talk with a Dutch accent. He said, I'll wear the baggy clothes, but I'm not talking with a Dutch accent. Well, they hired him, and he worked there in St. Joe, Missouri for about 16 months.
Wow.
Got enough money to get back home, which he did. And, you know, he from there, he went into burlesque as a dancing juvenile, which is sort of the warm-up for the Top Banana. And he was in various shows, and then he happened to get the Republic Theater in Corio's This Is Burlesque, and that's where my mother was in the chorus. She was the pony, the little one at the end. And it's a true story, you know, that he actually was so smitten by her, but he was also very shy. And so he kept asking Ann Corio, would you please introduce me to her? And Ann said, Lou, you can introduce yourself to her. And he says, no, no, no. He says, would you do it? Would you do it for me? So Ann said, sure, Lou, I'll do it. And she goes up to my mother, and she says, you know, Lou would love to take you out for a cup of coffee. And my mother looked at her and said, why would I want to go out with a comic? If I want to starve, I can starve on my own. And so, but my mom happened to be backstage one night watching him do, you know, his stint. And there was a hall tree on the stage. He did a turn, noticed her, accidentally knocked over the hall tree, which knocked her out cold because it fell backwards into the wings and knocked her out. And I guess when she came to, he said, would you have that cup of coffee with me? And she said, yes. And then 6 months later, they were married.
How cute.
So, but yes. a funny story, Grace, about that is that years later, back in the early 40s, Ann Corio had come out to Hollywood to do her films. And she was at our home on Longridge and remained a very close friend of my parents for up until, you know, both of they passed away. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting out by the pool, this expansive property in the San Fernando Valley. And Ann's looking around, you know, this huge house and beautiful pool. She looked at my mother and she said, well, Ann, just tell me one thing. How does it feel to be starving? And so, you know, but Ann was a really, really neat gal. I really enjoyed Ann. I liked her a lot.
So was he was Costello by then, right? Because his brother became Costello.
Pat always went by Cristello when he was with the orchestra. What happened, there are two or three floating stories, okay? And I wish God, Dad were here, so I could really narrow it down. The story that I have in the book, which would seem more appropriate, is, well, it kind of overlaps, is that Dad, out of to honor Dolores Costello for giving him the advice to go back east, this and that, had started adapting the last name of Costello, not legally, just as a stage name. Pat, on the other hand, when he was with his orchestra, Lillian Russell's daughter was in one of these after hour, you know, places where the people would gather after shows and stuff. And she said, what's your name? And he said, Pat Cristillo, or no, Anthony Cristillo. She said, too long. can't remember it. She said, where are you from? He said, Paterson, New Jersey. She said, there you go. Your name is Pat. And he became Pat after that. Never was known by Anthony after that. But I kind of, you know, have to go with what Dad, you know, had said, I think on This Is Your Life, that he took the name of Costello as a thank you, you know, to Dolores Costello. But also, and my sister Patty mentioned this, he did not want to bring shame on the family name of Costello if he failed. Mm. So, and we're talking again, another generation, another era.
Such an Italian,
you know,
guy.
The Italian Catholic, yes. You know. You know, that was one thing he did not want to do. So he took on a stage name, and but all of his legal work, you know, his passports, his all that stuff was Costello. So it was never changed legally.
Yes, and then he married your mom, and his mother was thrilled. What did you do to me? Yeah,
oh she loved my God! Her well, you know, it's she had three children, Pat, my father, and Marie, the daughter. Mm-hmm. And Marie, my Aunt Marie had just a wicked sense of humor. Oh, man, she was funny. And I can remember visiting with her when Grandma was still alive. And Grandma was a tough cookie to crack. You know, she really was. She wasn't your warm, cozy, you know, type of grandma. But at any rate, you know, she was talking about, you know, her son, my dad. And Aunt Marie looked at me one day, just started laughing, and she shook her head. She said, wait till she finds out she has a daughter. You know, but, you know, it was great. She was a tough cookie. You know, but he loved her, and he took very good care of her.
He did.
And family was everything to him, you know, and my mother respected that. She really did. Yes. And he was very good to her family as well.
Yeah. So they got married, and then somehow he hooks up with his teammate of 20. Mm-hmm. How long were they together? 21 years?
They were, I think, together, oh, gosh. I'm going to say 1936 to 1957.
Wow. Yeah, so that's 21 years.
A long time.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I think, too, back then, and, you know, people have asked on Facebook, and it's a question I'm always answering, is when they split, do I think they would have ever gotten back together? And, you know, my sister Patty said it beautifully. She said, you know, They scaled the mountain. They got to the very top. Where do you go from there?
That's true.
And, you know, when you think of it, they started out in 1936. Bud was very seasoned. You know, he was in the industry long before my father. He was one of the most sought-after straight men in the business. He had learned, I think, from his cousin, I think his name was Al Golden, on how to be a good straight man. And he was. I mean, there was every comic in the world wanted to work with Bud Abbott. Now Bud had a partner at one point, even his wife at one point was a partner, when she was a soubrette, and then they produced a show, and then she became like his straight woman. He became the comic, something like that. And my father, you know, had a couple of straight men that he worked with. And I think just fate had a way of intervening one night when his straight man got sick, and Bud happened to be on the bill that night, offered to fill in, knew all of the skits and the routines, and history was made. Dad went off, I think, to perform at the Orpheum. Bud was performing something. You know, would you like to team up? And history was made through that telegram, because Dad said yes.
And I think they were, I mean, what a luck that he was in the audience. I mean, it's just fate. It is fate, like you said. They were fated to be this wonderful team who is remembered mm-hmm. today. And they're mm-hmm. The thing is that there are new classic movie fans every day that are younger, you know, people in their teens, 20s, 30s, love them, you know?
Well, you know, one thing, I'm sorry I interrupted you there.
That's okay.
You know, one thing, Grace, I always like to make mention of is, and it's so important, I think, is that, you know, the teaming of Abbott and Costello, of course, Dad's character, you know, you have a lot of empathy for and sympathy, and that was the character. They worked together, you know, through Bud being sort of the con man type, you know, character, Dad's little boy, naivete.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, and especially women. Women wanted to mother him. They just felt so sorry for him. But, you know, as I've told people, you can't negate Bud Abbott here, because Bud truly was the glue. And by the glue, I mean he was the setup man. I mean, if anything failed in that routine, it would have fallen on Bud Abbott's shoulders. So, you know, a good straight man makes a comment look brilliant. And Bud Abbott, that's what he did. So, you know, when people say, well, I loved your dad more because he was... And I always stop him and go, no. You know, you got to give credit to this man, Bud Abbott. You know, and to me, he's the unsung hero.
I agree with you because he was fabulous. And like you said, your father was the cutie pie. And it's obvious he's cute. He's funny. He does the funny stuff. And the straight guy gets lost in the mix. And
well, they do.
And he was fabulous. They were such a wonderful team. And, you know, I was even just reading some of the routines I had never heard before. Who doesn't know who's on first? But I was reading them in the book, and I'm laughing out loud. I mean, I could just see them doing it. They were so funny.
Well, you know what it was is back in burlesque is all of these routines that Abbott and Costello did. They didn't invent the actual routine because those were all recycled routines that would just circulate. And all the comics shared them. But as it was explained to me through Ron Palumbo, who is the foremost authority on Abbott and Costello, he said that made it were the teams that could take a routine and stylize it into their own. And that's what Abbott and Costello did. So when people say, well, you know, it was the Three Stooges that created routine. Well, the Three Stooges did do the drill routine when they were with Ted Healy. But back then, it was everybody borrowed. It's not like today where I'm going to sue you, you know, yeah. If you do that routine. Back then, I think it was a little bit more relaxed, you know, within that community. And all Bud and Dad did was through their head comedy writer, John Grant, is they took a routine and we kind of refitted it with, you know, new dialogue to fit a situation. That's what they did in a lot of their films. You know, there's variations of one routine and you'll see them, you know, pop up in other, you know, films, but just in a different context.
Yeah, I mean, now it's like they don't do skits and stuff like that, really. Comics just do stand-up, and they do, you know what I mean? They're not that kind of a comedy, whereas, you know, in those days, Marx Brothers, your dad, and Bud Abbott, and all those other guys, they were there. Dino, you answered this rumor that I heard in your book for me about Dino and his nose job, and your dad paid for it.
There is more curiosity about this poor man's nose.
I laugh
and I go, what is the curiosity about this nose? I mean, my God. I mean, I think Dean Martin was a great entertainer. Let's talk about his songs. Let's talk about what he contributed.
I love him.
But now it's all about this nose.
No, I love him. I love him. People love him. And he was a great singer. I thought he was a great entertainer. And some people said he was like the funniest guy they knew. Naturally, the funniest guy they knew. And no, I love Dean, but I was just surprised. I thought that was so sweet that your father paid for his nose job. I just like, boy, that's nice to pay for somebody's nose job.
There was a lot of, you know, again, I love tackling, you know, when people say, well, I heard that Dean Martin and Lou Costello hated each other and they didn't speak after Lou paid for the nose job. And I go, oh my gosh, you know, I don't know. I wasn't there. But I can say this is the press has such a great way of magnifying, you know, what is just a glimmer of truth and then it explodes into this massive story, you know, never before heard.
Hatred.
Yes. And I'll tell you one thing right now. And my sister Carol, who did pass away in 87, was never married to Craig Martin. They were dating. They were living together. They were never married. Carol was a friend of the Martin family for years. And I remember her always saying, what a gentleman Dean was. He always treated her like family and always commented on how much respect he had for Dad. So I always look at these rumors and I take them really with a grain of salt. You know, you have to. You just have to. But, you know, Dean Martin was a great entertainer.
He was fabulous. I love, you know, I just love him.
Yeah.
Also, so they finally get, they're this wonderful team, and Hollywood does call for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that was due to the Kate Smith Show.
Oh,
radio is really what catapulted them onto the next level and into Hollywood, which, you know, burlesque was winding down. It was ready to close. And Dad kind of was this, he kind of saw beyond and was always wanting to move to the next step and up the bar a little bit.
Yeah.
Bud's nature, okay, his nature was more laid back. But when he went on the Kate Smith Show at first, really didn't think they were going to work in radio. He was very hesitant about putting them on, but Henny Youngman was ready to leave the show because of going out to Hollywood to do a film, and he had suggested, Ted, you got to see these two guys, you know, over at the Lyceum Theater. So Ted Collins had gone to the theater, and he said afterwards, he said, he said, you know, they're okay, but I don't see them translating into radio. They're very visual. Well, they persisted and persisted and persisted, and finally, Morris Agency, and Dad and Bud had just signed with the Morris Agency. He had connections with the Kate Smith Show, had booked a lot of guests on the show, and he had made the recommendation to Collins to did, and they went on the show, and it was okay. You know, it was earth shattering. They were okay, but it was Collins who said to Dad, he said, "You've got to change voices because the radio audience can't tell who is who." So it was when Ted came up with that, the Dad started working up that high whine, you know, with that "I'm a bad boy" and altering his voice a little bit so that the listening audience could tell who was who. Uh-huh. But if it had not been for Who's On First, God knows where they would have gone, because it was Who's On First that basically was the launching pad. And Ted Collins did not want that routine. He did not like the routine. He called it a silly baseball skit. But
so funny.
Dad and Bud knew that they had this on the air. And they told Ted, you know, one night, just, I think it was like, "Ted, don't have any more material to use. You know, so I guess we can't go on tonight." He said, "You got to go on tonight." He said, "Do anything. I don't care what you do, that silly baseball thing." He did. And the audience reaction was absolutely amazing. And Eileen Flores, who I interviewed for my book, she worked for NBC, and she said that she was on the switchboard that night, and she said it lit up like a Christmas tree. So that was what motivated Universal to say they wanted to bring them out to Hollywood for a test film in an Alan Jones, Nancy Kelly film called One Night in the Tropics. And, of course, that film hence became very much an Abbott and Costello film, because they kept adding more and more and more Abbott and Costello. And a funny story, which I believe is in the book, is I was talking to Alan Jones, and this was when I was interviewing people for the book, and he started laughing. He said, "I got to tell you a story." He said, this was my film. He said, and it was the first time, I don't know why, I never exercised my editing rights. He said, well, he said, years later, he said, "I happened to be in South America. I'm walking down a street. I see a movie theater marquee, and on the marquee, it says Abbott and Costello in One Night in the Tropics." And he stopped and he said, "Where the hell am I?" I, you know. So that was the test film. And then from there, of course, they went into Buck Privates, and their career was already, it was on the rise, especially after Buck Privates.
And that's when they moved out, and then they both brought mm-hmm. their families out.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Did Bud bring his family, like his sister, brother, like
yes,
you did?
Yes, everybody came out, everybody. Yeah. It was like the Barnum and Bailey circus coming out. I mean, if one came, they all came.
So that was nice. The whole gang was together. When was your, so Patty was the first child.
Patty was the first child. Both Patty and Carol were born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, when he was doing burlesque. And the reason why was that Dad was on the road a lot, and Mom wanted to be closer to, you know, her mother and father. And so she would go there, and that's where, you know, they were born. And then she'd come back to New Jersey. And then my brother, Lou Jr., and myself were born in California. And Lou, of course, Jr., passed away in 44.
Yeah, we'll talk about that because that's a big part of both of your parents' lives. But so you weren't there for all this beginning stuff, but your father built this humongo house. Mm-hmm. It sounds beautiful. I mean, he kept adding rooms. It ended up being wasn't it a 24-room mansion?
It was 22 rooms, and I have to say, it was Universal. It was Universal that built that house.
Yes.
But he just, he wanted a big house, and he got it. And my mom used to say, because he used to take things off the set.
That is so funny.
Used to take things off the set. My mother would say her home was decorated in early Universal.
It's a riot.
Know, but,
sticky fingers there. Sticky fingers.
It wasn't like, you know, in a couple of the books I've read, which I just hate to mention. But, you know, where, he was this bad person who liked to steal things off the set.
No, it doesn't come off like that.
And, you know, it was like Patty Andrews told me. She said, you know, he was like the studio's pex bad boy, you know, but he would use that as leverage to get what he wanted, especially when it came to crew and cast. So, you know, or if he felt adamant about a contractual thing, et cetera, he had no qualms saying to, you know, the studio, hey, you know, that couch that's in that scene we're doing, that's a pretty nice looking couch. You know, I just hope my cigar is not lit when I'm standing next to that beautiful couch. And of course they would always say, you know, whatever you want, Lou, whatever you want, just, you know, do not.
But he was basically, Bud, which I never knew, he had epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't drive himself, and he always had a fear that he would have an attack, and he was also a heavy-duty drinker.
Well, you know, I got, you know, wow, it's you know, this gets into such a sensitive area because, you know, I've got to say that, you know, yes, he did have epilepsy. It was not a severe form of epilepsy, but enough of it to create this fear in him of having an attack, which is why he would say to my dad, if you ever see me start to stiffen up, I want you to take your fist and double it up and as hard as you can punch me in the gut. Well, Dad, you know, would tell the directors or, you know, who was ever on the set, if you ever see me, you know, punch Bud in the gut, I'm doing it to bring him out of having a seizure. And that was, you know, fine. But Bud never drank, you know, when they were working. Never. It was 4 o'clock, you know, and that's when, you know, they left. And I think, you know, back then there was social drinking. Okay.
Yes.
That was an era. Everybody smoked. Everybody drank.
Everybody had a bar in their house.
Exactly, Grace. But, you know, in today's world, oh, my God, they smell. Oh, my God. They, you know, he had 2 drinks. He must be an alcoholic.
Oh,
and so you have to look at that era.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Bud did, you know, drink to alleviate these fears he had of having an attack. So in all fairness to Bud, I really have to say that, you know, would I classify him as an alcoholic? Absolutely not, you know. But again, you know, the press has this magical way of creating the story and it sticks.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, on Facebook, I'm always, you know, answering these questions over and over and over and over again, you know, trying to unstick it. But, you know, it keeps sticking.
Well, so. It sticks with me. I won't ask again. It's stuck.
No. But, you know, it's just in all fairness to the man. You know, and I wish to God somebody would do a book on him because the man deserves it. He deserves to have his voice told, you know. And one of the things I did when I was interviewing everybody, you know, that I could get my hands on. I would always ask them, can you give me stories about Bud? And it was interesting because many of them said, I wish I could. They said, I can't, though, because your dad was the one who was really out amongst people on the set where Bud would maybe retire to the trailer or something like that. He was more quiet,
yeah.
You know, and I always say Bud was a gentleman and a gentleman.
I think so, too. I just got
he
that.
He really, really was, you yeah. know, and I always felt so bad for Bud, which is why I do what I can on Facebook to really promote who he really was, because he was a dear man, a sensitive man. He adored my father. They were like brothers. Like brothers.
Like brothers, which means love, hate, you know.
Yes,
you
and they fought them. Like brothers.
Right.
You know, when people say, oh my God, did they hate each other? And did they ever have an argument? I'd say, if they didn't have an argument, I would say that's one unhealthy relationship.
Yes.
Because they were with each other more than they were with their own wives.
Well, I hear people who are married and they say, oh, we've never had an argument. And I say, what kind of freaks are you?
Exactly.
How can
exactly.
you be married? How are you a human being? How can you
exactly.
not?
Exactly. Exactly. You cannot be together 25 years or 21 years and not have an argument. You know, two different types of personalities. And, you know, did they at times, you know, dissolve the act for 48 hours or whatever? Yeah, they did. You know, was it sometimes, you know, instigated by my dad? Yeah, sometimes it was. But you know what? There was such a deep love and bond there. They loved like brothers. They fought like brothers, you know. And believe me, God help anybody to say anything derogatory about Bud Abbott in my father's presence, because he'd nail you, you know. So it was a friendship, and the friendship continues to this day with the Abbotts, you know, and the Costellos.
Did he have children? Did Bud and his wife have children?
They didn't have biological children. They're two adopted children, Bud Jr. and his sister, Becky. Bud Jr. I was very close to. Gem, just a gem. Somebody who just mirrored his father. Just a sweet guy who never had an unkind word for anybody. And he loved the fans. He loved going out there. And he would have loved being on your podcast.
I would have loved to talk to him.
And he had such great stories. Such great stories. Sadly, he passed. I think it was 98.
And the book, well, yeah. Who will write the book on Bud? Who will have the whole thing?
I wish. You know, I don't know. I wish somebody would. You know, I truly do. It's time. You know, I always say, and this is for anybody, regardless of how famous your parents are, your grandparents are, whatever, is everybody has this story, Grace. And when they go and they leave this world, those stories go with them. You know, so I, being an archivist, man, I say, please record, you know, don't let these stories just evaporate and leave. And it's the same thing, you know, with Bud. I wish somebody would, you know, do a piece on him, a book on him. He deserves it.
If any of you, I have a lot of authors on this show, so come on, one of you authors, let's get that book going. Okay.
I would love it.
Yes.
I would love it. I would promote it so much because the guy deserves it. He really does.
And I think it must be really hard because, you know, these people that kiss your butt, whatever. Oh, Lou. Mm-hmm. Bud would be nothing without you. He
hangers on.
You know, those people
on.
Do that kind of thing.
Yeah, they
and
do.
That really
they do.
Bugs me. And they do, yeah. You know, well, I'll tell you, Jerry Lewis bugged me. I didn't really like that team. I love Dino, but I didn't really ever see them as a team because I was not born yet. But, you know, he still bugged me anyway. But that little boy, stupid thing.
He did that when he was visiting our house around Halloween. And he was sitting in the den with Dad, and we had these like TV recliners, that Naugahyde, you know, TV recliners. And I remember that I wanted to show Dad my witch's costume for Halloween. And so they let me go into the den, and Jerry Lewis and he, they were sitting across from each other, you know, on these recliners. And when Jerry saw me, he immediately went into his Jerry Lewis routine. He started, you know, you know, falling off the chair, this and that. And I just broke me up laughing. And that was my one and only memory of Jerry Lewis. You know, he entertained me because of my witch outfit.
Well, of course, and you were a child. So he's I would have laughed my head off as well.
Yeah.
Your father was so generous. I mean, to a really incredible fault, I think. Like Christmas, he'd go out, he bought like televisions for everybody.
Oh, he would
buy, people would sit at the thing, and you said in your book, they'd say, what did you get? Like,
a competition.
And he would get everything. He must have spent, I don't know how much money on Christmas presents for people he probably didn't even know half the time.
That's true. Well, there's an expression I love using, and it probably goes back to that era when somebody was as giving as that. They have long arms, short pockets. And he looked at money as a way of giving. Okay. That was just who he was. That was his basic nature to give, not just to his family, but to anybody, you know. And I mean, the people, you know, when people have said, how would you like your father to be remembered? Well, of course, by being Abbott and Costello, but also as a humanitarian, because there are people that he paid for operations for that he never knew. You know, any child in need or needed help, he was right there. So was Bud. He needed to give back. And you put a child in front of him, you know, and boy, that was it. You know, he went right into Lou Costello, the character. You know, or Universal, there's a story in a book, Joe Elias and his wife, who ran the Universal concession. And Joe needed an operation, but would not close down the concession stand because that was their income. And Dad said, you're going to have the operation. Well, my dad set it up with the best doctor, best hospital, you know. He said, Joe, you're going. You're not going to worry about your wife. We're going to take care of everything while you're recuperating. And what happened is when Joe went to get the operation, Dad and Bud every morning going onto the Universal lot would go over to the concession stand and buy everything, you know, to keep, you know, that stand going while Joe was recuperating.
I love that story.
Who they were. That's who they were.
I love that. And he did so much for everybody. Let's get into, your father was very outgoing, but you know, he was really, he wasn't really expressive with his feelings at all.
No.
He loved you kids. Let's get into, because you didn't know this, you weren't born yet, but the birth of Lou Jr., which was ecstatic time for your father. And
oh, sure.
His nickname was Butch. Uh-huh. And, you know, he was a little boy. Your father was thrilled, Lou Jr. And he went on a tour for the war bonds, and he got ill. He got rheumatic fever.
Well, he did. And he had a convalescence of over a year.
Wow.
So it gave him time to really be with that baby, because with Patty and Carol, my older sisters, you know, he was working burlesque. So he really didn't have that opportunity to spend all of that time, you know, the first crawl, the first walk, stuff like that. And with what she did. And they would both, you know, he was learning how to, you know, do certain things. So he'd get on his hands and knees and they would crawl together across the floor. And he had, his first day back to the Abbott and Costello radio show, he had asked my mother to keep the baby up to see if he could recognize his voice over the air.
Oh, this was the first day back after his illness?
This was the first day back on his radio show with Bud. And my mother had left to go pick up a stroller at a place called Babytown, which was maybe 15, 20 minutes away at the most from the house. And it was a situation where this one thought that one was watching the baby. And there was a slat that evidently had gotten loose. And Butch earned his nickname because he was really robust and he liked to shake things.
Yeah.
And, you know, he managed to shake this slat loose. And
he was in a playpen by the pool.
Playpen. Yeah. Uh-huh. But he wasn't by the pool. See, this is the misconception, is that there was a gate and a barrier, and the gate was open, and then beyond the gate was the pool. And he had managed to crawl out and into the pool. And when my mother got home and she saw that the playpen was empty, she thought that somebody had put him down for a nap. So she went upstairs and he wasn't in his crib. So she came running down the stairs. And Marty, who was Pat's wife, my Aunt Marty, was Dad's secretary at the time, and she had just started working for him. And Mom was saying, where's the baby? And she said, I don't know. And she said, he's not in his playpen. So my mother immediately started running out the back door, and then Marty could hear the blood-curdling screams, oh, Jesus, and going into the pool, you know. So that was really
horrible. Yeah. And then your father was extra excited because Butch was going to turn 1 year old in a couple of days, and he was all excited for his one-year-old birthday party.
Yeah,
and his first
pair of hard-soled shoes. Another era.
Yes, I know. And so your Aunt Marie was supposed to call Bud, I mean your dad, and she couldn't do it. So who had to tell your father?
Well, when my father was brought home, Eddie Sherman, the manager
at
the studio,
yeah,
just said, bring Lou home. And Eddie said, is it Butch? And they said, yes. So when Dad walked into the home, the doctor, Dr. Kovner, who was the family doctor, was there and, you know, told him, you know, that, Butch, you know, was gone. And so he was going to go back to the studio and do the show. And everybody was congregating in his den. And my aunt was there. And Harry Abbott, who was Bud's older brother, who my dad just absolutely adored. And calls were coming in, Mickey Rooney, this one, that one, offering to take his place that night. And he said, no, he said, I'm going back to the studio. And that's when his sister Marie said, you know, how can you go back? And he said, because I asked Anne to keep the baby up tonight to see, you know, if he could hear my voice, and wherever God has taken my son, you know, I want him to know he can still hear me. So
that is a heartbreaking story.
He did it. And then, of course, you know, he did the show, and then he collapsed afterwards. And his dear friend, Milt Bronson, drove him home. And Bud made that beautiful, you know, announcement, very from the heart.
Yes, announced. It was.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is sad. But, you know, I think where, you know, Dad was able to find some peace was when he and Bud decided that they wanted to do something for the kids. And that's when he decided to build the Lou Costello Jr. Youth Center in East Los Angeles. And they did not want to have it built in an affluent area. They wanted the worst looking area possible. They wanted the baddest area.
So they could really be of help.
So they could, yes.
The kids really needed that help.
Yes, exactly. And so they found the perfect location in the Boyle Heights District of East LA, still operating today under the Parks and Recreation. And they toured to raise the necessary funds, and I think it took them maybe for about 2 years, and then the center opened in May of 1947, just about 3 months before I came along, and he wanted to offer these kids every opportunity to get off the street, out of gangs, back into school. He wanted to give them a structure. He built an Olympic-sized swimming pool, and every child would be given swimming lessons and no charge, absolutely no charge. No child paid for anything going into that facility. He had a soda fountain built. He had a theater built. He had the basketball courts,
wow,
the baseball diamond. He had a children's center, babies center, anything and everything, you know, a medical center for kids. He wanted to give back. And I think that that's what gave him purpose,
yeah,
you know. It's sort of like, you know, unfortunately, the baby lost his life, but to give life to others.
Yeah.
You know.
But the baby's death sort of put instead of coming together, it put a wedge between your parents, which your mother really needed him, but he kind of withdrew.
And it was a strain, yeah.
Yeah, and the Lou's mother, your grandma, she blamed Anne, your mom, and said, "What did you do to my son's son?
You know, why did you allow my son's boy to die?"
Yes, I mean, come on, this woman is devastated, and I'm sure she had your dad's ear on it and probably going on and on. And poor, your mother didn't have enough guilt. Of course she did.
Yeah.
She
felt
terrible. Well, horrible.
You know, I think you're dealing now. See, again, it's like two different personalities, because Dad was that era to him, you know, he kind of like put his feelings inside, you
right.
know, boys don't cry, you know, you hold in. And Mom was very much, she wore her heart on her sleeve. But I also always like to reiterate the fact that there was a strain in the marriage. Yes, there was, but there was still a deep love, which is why I dedicated the book to her.
I love you know? That dedication to your mom. She deserved it. She loved your dad and she,
oh God, yes. Oh God, yes. And he loved her. It was just, he didn't know how to help her because he didn't know how to help himself, you know, through the agony. You know, you hear of so many people who have lost children, you know, in some kind of an accident yes. or something like that nature. And more oftentimes than not, these marriages disintegrate, you
right.
know,
very rarely do they come together.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But I truly feel that even though there was a strain, you know, there was a lot of frustration, that there was still a deep love. And, because he was always very, 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 you know, attentive to her. And, you know, she turned to alcohol. That was gave her her, you know, that allowed her to cope. You know, it just allowed her to cope. And she was a great woman. She was a fantastic woman. She was so family oriented. You know, she could have been a comic, whether he was a plumber, she could have cared less. I mean, this woman, he was Scott Truth 12, but she knew the value of and believed it. Mates, not to clean up our rooms, that we would clean our own rooms, we would get an allowance. You know, she could be stern, but with a lot of love. And, you know, I mean, that's who she was. She would go out, she'd buy clothes from, put in a designer label. I mean, she would collect receipts off the floor of the office and hand them to, you know, Dee Dee, the secretary, and say, this is, these are my receipts. Can you give me the petty cash? And so Dee Dee would. So what my mother would do is take the cash and put it in her strong box in her closet. Because she said that, you know, she had like $10,000 in there at one point just collecting receipts off the floor. But this was her mad money for a rainy day. You know, she always believed in that rainy day. And so it's that's who she was. You know, Dad, on the other hand, like, okay, Christmas time, they'd give a big party at Longreach. My dad did not drink, except maybe at Christmas time he'd have one drink. And one drink or two sips would just throw him, you know. And he'd be handing out $100 bills, you know, to people. And my mother would be right behind him collecting them right back.
I love that.
You know?
And how could they take it at Christmas? How could they do that? Why would they do it?
Oh, well, you know, there's always the hangers-on. Ugh. Always the hangers-on.
Yeah, your father was too kind, you know, and your mother... she was a champ. I got to give her that.
Thank you.
Yeah, she really was. So after all this stuff happened, there came you.
There came me.
And your father was thrilled, and you became his pal.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, a combination of being the youngest, because there was a 9 and 12-year difference between my sisters and myself, and... you know, I was the baby. I came after the babies, you know, that he lost. And so I think I was a little bit more overly coddled, spoiled. I was his shadow. Wherever he went, I was right there. And, you know, I had a wonderful memories of him. Very, very wonderful, wonderful memories of him. I feel blessed that I had him as my father, not because he was Lou Costello, the comic, but who he was, you know, as the man. He was very family oriented. Family was everything to him. And so I was blessed. And, you know, as it, you know, I had him for a very short time, but, you know, within that short time, he gave me much love, many memories to last an entire lifetime. So yes. I feel blessed, really blessed.
You were lucky, and I love how close he was to you and you guys went there. He had his problems, the IRS, but we'll skip that. Let's go to the breakup.
Well, let me just say, first of all, on the IRS, they did not die broke. That has been, again, another hyped a story that, you know, the press clumbed onto and took off with it. They did not die broke. The IRS knocked off the penalty tax. They had an excellent IRS attorney who used to work for the State Department. He explained to the U.S. government that these two men are not trying to defraud the U.S. government.
They're not crooks.
It was faulty. It was faulty business management on the part of my dad's business manager, who was not reporting back payroll taxes on the corporation for the TV show. So, you know, I always like to make that quite clear. The debt was paid before both men passed away.
Yes. But you had to sell your house.
Well, he had to tighten the reins. Yes, and he had to release, you know, the youth center to the city of Los Angeles.
Yeah,
and which the city is doing a beautiful job.
Yeah, I heard
and
it's still
going strong. My sister and I visit it as often as we can. But yeah, they had to tighten the belt.
And
you
was
know, the
it
financial
somebody tattletaled, wasn't it? Somebody, some disgruntled person, had the IRS look into it.
No, the IRS was tipped off because of the accountant constantly asking for an extension for not filing the payroll taxes, which tipped them off. But at any rate, you know, it all corrected itself. But then we're going into now the 50s where they're,
right.
You know, it's you know, my dad's health was not that great.
No,
you know?
I didn't know rheumatic fever came back. You know, that
it probably was due to strep throat as a kid, you know, with the virus lingers.
Yes.
He got the rheumatic fever, but it weakens the heart valves. They didn't know that back then. Today, it would have been easy. You know, you go in for a valve replacement. But back then, they just didn't have, you know, that medical
knowledge or equipment
exactly.
to do any of that stuff.
Exactly.
So that's something, because I didn't read that your father died broke, but, you know, because I was doing some researching, you know, looking up everything. And it said that Bud died broke, but he didn't die broke.
No. You know, the National Enquirer set him up. And I really, you know, that's where I get so upset with these rag magazines, the tabloids, you know. I'm sorry, it just gnaws at me. But no, they set the guy up, you know, and it was unfair, and it was a slap in his face. And, you know, it's sometimes I don't have a real love affair with the press because, you know, if you're going to say something, then say it right. So,
well, in
you
the
know,
world but, of the tabloid press, they don't feel that they have to. It's like not double check.
Well, it's
check
what's going to sell. What's going to sell?
Right,
what's
so.
Going to sell? What is going to sell copy? You know, it's the same thing with that book, Bun Lou, you know, the Bob Thomas and the disgruntled ex-manager, you know, wrote. I mean, you know what it was?
I never even knew he wrote a book. Yeah,
well,
this year's
what
the
it
only
was,
book I saw.
What it was is they wait till people pass away, so then they zero in. And to me, it was nothing more than a blatant slap in my father's face, especially by Eddie Sherman, who feigned this friendship, you know, for all these years.
No.
And it was a way to make money. It was a way to make money. And the way I know that is my sister Carol was on the phone with Bob Thomas when that book was released, and they did not want the families to know about this book. Not one member of the Abbott or the Costello families were ever interviewed for this book. Mm-hmm. And my sister was saying, I walked in and she was saying, how could you write something so blatantly false about my father? And the response coming back was, and I quote, unfortunately, Carol, you don't sell a book by being nice. Well, I heard that and I thought, I bet you could sell a book by being fair. And that's what launched me into wanting to do a book to correct the story. There would have been no Lose on First had it not been for that book. But I corrected the story. I did it for my father. I did it for his fans. I did it for my family. You know, that this is the book. This was written by everybody that knew him. So, you know, it's you're always going to find that. It's always going to happen. It's always going to happen.
Their split came. Your father wasn't feeling well anymore. There was just a lot going on.
Yeah.
And who decided to split? Was this pretty mutual?
No, I think it was my dad because, you know, he wanted to try dramatic acting. You know, he was getting some offers, I believe, and they were older. They were slowing down. The scripts were not as good as they used to be. Mm. The comedy was changing. Films were changing.
Yes,
music was changing. you know, it, they were writing sort of like on you know, the Lenny Bruces were, the Lenny Bruce was coming up in the ranks. So, you know, it was time. It was just simply time. And, you know, it's, I can't fault him for that. I really can't either
because, you know, so, they had a long run. They had a great run. And they're known today. I remember watching them on Saturdays to see the Lou. They would have Saturday afternoon or Sunday morning movies of Abbott and Costello. And I was a little kid, and I would be scared of they meet Frankenstein and things like that. I would be terrified.
Yeah.
But I loved them. And, I, you know, look at them today. They are beloved. Yeah. And when I told people I was having you on, they said, I can't wait to listen. And they loved
Abbott and Costello. Well, I could go on and on, and unfortunately I've got to run in about 15 minutes. But well, Grace, I would love to do another podcast with
you. Yes, I have more questions for you. There's some really juicy stuff I have to ask you.
But, you know, and we'll talk about, you know, I've got a new podcast.
Very exciting.
The first one called On Cue with Chris Costello, and hopefully we're going to be up and running in a few weeks. And, you know,
and it's fun. It is fun.
And we've got some great guests. So we're looking forward to, in fact, the first one will be with Francis Gary Powers Jr. on his book Spy Pilot. And he's wonderful, wonderful. So it's, you know, we're excited. And then also my book, Luzon First, is an ebook they can purchase now through Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
I highly recommend.
And I've also got my other career, which is I'm a travel agent. I wear so many hats, you cannot believe it.
God bless you.
Oh, thank you.
I know, you're a busy, busy bee.
But I love it. I love it.
So I'm going to put all your information on when I post this. And I hope we can talk more because I want to talk about Veronica Lake and Clark Gable.
Oh, absolutely. We'll do another podcast. And also, if I can just make one mention.
Sure.
Is we have a newsletter called Abbott and Costello Newsletter, which goes out the first of every month. It's free. And if anybody would like to get onto the subscriber list, they can send me an email, which is accollectibles@aol.com. So it's AC and then collectibles@aol.com, and we'll get them on.
Great.
Or they can also
go ahead.
And they can also check on with me on Facebook. Okay.
Okay. And I will put these links down anyway so people can.
Beautiful.
Check you out. And thank you so much, Chris. I enjoy talking to you. And I do still have some more questions, definitely.
Absolutely.
I appreciate the time you gave me.
Thank you so much, Grace. And can I put Pam Wise in touch with you?
Sure, certainly.
Beautiful.
Okay,
beautiful.
Thanks, everybody.
Let's keep in touch, Chris.
Definitely.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye, Chris.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
With his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean, that's entertainment. The lights on the lady in tights, or the bride with the guy on the side, or the ball where she gives him her all, that's entertainment. Be hot, simply teeming with sex. A gay divorcee who is after her ex. It can be Oedipus Rex, where a chap kills his father and costs a lot of bother. The clerk who is thrown out of work by the boss, who is thrown for a loss by the skirt, who is doing him dirt. The world is the stage. The stage is a world of entertainment. fight like you see on the screen. A swain getting slain for the love of a queen. Some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet, and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gag may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan hip hooray, the American.